Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In the introduction to Andre Leontali's memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, the former Vogue editor-at-large writes, quote, "I was a fixture, a force, and a fierce advocate of fashion and style." We learn that high on the list of things that matter the most to the pioneering fashion journalist are his grandmother, good manners, faith, and good clothes. Raised in Durham, North Carolina, where he devoured glossies as a young man, Talley made his own way, ultimately arriving in New York City and Paris into a world that was predominantly white and not always welcoming. The names of the powerful and stylish embellish every page of this book. Karl Lagerfeld, John Galliano, Lee Radziwill. The result is both a collection of memories from the industry's most extravagant as well as exclusionary days and a very personal story about drive and how even sometimes it isn't enough when faced with the fashion world's isms, ageism, racism, sizeism. Yet to this day, Talley remains devoted to style. His memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, is out. And Andre, welcome to All of It.
Thank you.
So the title, The Chiffon Trenches, you associate it with warfare and being in the trenches with fellow soldiers. What did you want to telegraph to us about your own experience in the fashion industry with that title?
That it was a warfare and that there were fellow soldiers and I survived. That I was not defeated. I was victorious and triumphant. I've climbed up out of the trenches many, many times and through many decades.
What do you think, why did you climb out? What was the characteristic?
Through survival, through my brains, through my smartness, through my knowledge, and through my education. I had the creds. I had my degrees. I had my master's degree in French literature. I was smart. This is how I got through the trenches. Mm-hmm. I had the strategies to climb through and navigate, and I survived. I survived on my smartness, on my brains, not on my looks. It wasn't about my color. It was because I was smart.
Now, you grew up in Durham, North Carolina, and it's very clear your devotion to your family, specifically your grandmother mm-hmm. and great-grandmother. What life lessons did she teach you that have served you well personally and professionally?
Discipline, maintenance, honor, faith, structure, and kindness, humility, and empathy. Those are the things that I learned from my grandmother. She set the role. She was a great role model. She was very humble, humility, yet she was very strong. And through the lessons imposed upon me from my upbringing, she raised me right, and I do not regret it, and it lives with me today. Manners, uprightness, cleanliness, scrubbing, waxing floors, wonderful laundry, mm-hmm. beautiful sheets, air-dried sheets, starched sheets, etc., etc. I learned all my lessons from my grandmother in her house, and faith. And we went to church every Sunday. We had a family. The church what I grew up in was a family church founded by my ancestors. So the collective consciousness of the ancestral recall has permeated everything I've ever done and every moment of my existence and every day as I walk through the trenches of chiffon of life. In general, as I walk through the trenches, I have to have something to propel me into triumph, and this is what it is: faith, structure, humility, honor, dignity.
Now, you said something interesting there. For people who don't know what it means for a Southern grandmother to raise you right, can you explain what raise you right means?
Raising you right is simply giving you the values that are important to be able to sustain oneself through the adult life and through career, family. Raising right means that you're guided along the straight and narrow. Raising right means that you show manners to your elders, you show respect to your neighbors, you are kind to your neighbors, you show humility, and you show a responsibility. You have a moral code to be part of a community that totally responds to you, and you respond and you give out to the community, and you are generous and you are kind. The most important thing is that you are kind and you have a Christian charity towards humankind.
My guest is Andre Leontali. The name of his memoir is The Chiffon Trenches. Now, were there any life lessons that you learned during that time that didn't serve you because they were for a time and they were a way a certain generation grew up.
No, it passes down from generation to generation. Generational, this is non-generational. These are values that you, humans, if you're lucky enough to have them. Listen, I could have gone down the wrong path. I could have ended up being a gangster or a thug or not having gone to college. I mean, I didn't pursue those things, and it didn't happen to me. But you just never know. You have to have someone to raise you right. Right is depending, is relative to the individual. So I don't know how to express it, that right is just right. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you really can define, give it a definition based on a book, it's not a Webster's definition. Raise right is it relates to all people, Chinese people, black people, white people, Spanish people, Puerto Rican people. Raise right is a very important aspect of getting on with your life and your career. You were brought up right, it will follow you through your life.
In the book, your faith comes up repeatedly. How did your faith, or did your faith, I don't want to assume this, how did your faith help you in the world of fashion, or was that a separate part of your life?
No, I always had it with me. I didn't wear it on my sleeve, but it was always internal, and it always gave me the strength. I always had the structure of my faith. I always went to church. I didn't go to church that much in Paris. I did go to churches in Paris, of course, but on a regular basis, I'm in church once a week on Sundays, regularly, and that is an important moment in the week in my life. On a Sunday morning, the ritual of church is a very strong aspect of my life as an African-American man who was brought up in the Missionary Baptist Church. I grew up in a small family church. I go to the Abyssinian Baptist Church on 138th Street and Odell Clark Place in New York, the oldest African-American church in the state, the great state of New York. It's 211 years old this year, maybe 212. Forgive me if I don't have the exact age of the church, but it is a very strong church. Going to church, the sanctuary, you will be renewed through the sermon, the songs, the prayer, the reading of the word. There is something in the church that you can't put your hands on it. When you leave the church, you will leave the church a stronger person, a renewed person, even though you might have had some ups, some downs during the week, but when you come out of the church, you feel renewed.
Part of what you're describing please continue.
No, I'm sorry. Sorry, you go.
Part of what I'm listening to when I hear you talking about, it's a lot of it, of course, is faith, but it's also ritual, the ritual of doing something.
Ritual is everything. Ritual is part of a time on it. Routine is strong in one's life, is structure. Ritualistic is the church going. Ritualistic is, for instance, getting up and deep cleaning your apartment once a week. If you say you get up on a Monday, I have a friend, she gets up on Monday and she cleans her whole apartment. That's what she does on Monday during the pandemic. Another friend gets up on Fridays and cleans. So this is a ritual, and these rituals, these life chores, give you a structure, and that structure helps you to survive. You don't survive in chaos. You survive in order. There's order. The church and your faith gives an order to your life. It gives you a very strong sense of order and organization.
What are rituals in the fashion industry that are important?
Some of the rituals that are important are deportment or good behavior, politeness, a kind of strong camaraderie or kinship when you find a designers that somehow their clothes respond to you and you can build friendships over the years. I've built great friendships. Ralph Lauren, Carolina Herrera, Oscar de la Renta, Michael Kors. These are friendships that I've built and nurtured over years, decades and decades of time. And it's not just because they have designed a beautiful dress, but we all have become friends because we have a certain kind, we are aligned because of our mutual interests in beauty, decor, gardens, music, opera, literature, dance, etc., etc.
Why are all of those things you mentioned important in a time like we're living through right now?
Because it will sustain you. It simply sustains you. It gives you sustenance. It gives you substance. You must have these things as motivation, reading books. Whenever I get a book, an Amazon package arrives as a book, it's like Christmas morning through the pandemic. I'm only getting books in my house. I get books every other day, and the books are what sustain me. You know, I'm reading Susan Sontag's great biography, a Pulitzer Prize winning book that recently got the Pulitzer Prize. I'm reading Andy Warhol's great 900-page biography by Blake Gopnik. And these are the things that sustain you. You must always be curious. Curiosity is a prime point in being able to survive, because when you're curious, you learn something new every day. And I read this beautiful biography of Susan Sontag. I remember the author's name. He's a German man. It was translated into English. But it's just an extraordinary biography, because she had the structure of literature as a young child. She was reading already the great classics. By the age of 14, she was reading Thackeray, Dickens, and this is what made her the great intellectual thinker that she was, that she became. So it's ritual. You know, you have something. If you love art, if you love painting, if you love music, you just must steep yourself in those disciplines, and, you know, they will give you strength to go forward and inspire you.
My guess is Andre Leontali.
Can be very inspiring, too.
It can be. I agree. My guess is Andre Leontali. Of course, he is the former Vogue editor-at-large and creative director. He has a new memoir called The Chiffon Trenches. What do you remember what the first images were, the first fashion images you saw that really lit a fire in you, that you thought, this is what how I want to spend my life, this is what I want to be devote myself to?
Excuse me, I'm coughing. Well, the first images I had of fashion were images from Vogue magazine when I started reading Vogue at around the age of 9. And I was so extraordinarily struck by the kind of diversity that I would see. In those days, the African-American models were Pat Cleveland, mm-hmm. Naomi Sims, and then the great, great model was Princess Elizabeth Otoro. She was from an African nation, and she was royalty, African royalty, and she was a great model in Vogue. So when I opened Vogue and saw these women of color modeling, it was very inspiring to me. Naomi Sims, I also knew Naomi Sims before she died. I became friends with her. This was very important to open this very wonderful world, this world of luxury and escapism, and see that they had included. In those days, there were not a lot of models of color, but there was Elizabeth Otoro, and also there was Chyna Machado, who was an Asian model, high fashion model. And I mean, in those days, Asian models just were unique and rare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were pioneers. Naomi Sims, Pat Cleveland, and et cetera, et cetera.
You mentioned earlier you majored in French studies at North Carolina Central University and then went on to Brown, my alma mater. Love Brown. Love Providence.
Oh, yes.
and you at one point thought about being a French teacher.
Yes.
Why did you think about being a French teacher, and then why did you decide not to be a French teacher?
Well, I wanted to be a French teacher because that's what I went to Brown for, to study, and I thought that would be the right career move. And then when I wrote 200 letters and to schools, private boarding schools, and didn't get a position, then I thought it was not the right thing, because the 200 letters were rejecting letters, and I was always interested in fashion. And so my friend said, come to New York. You should really be in fashion, because that's what your love is, your passion is. And I followed them, and I had a great friend who was an instructor, an art professor at the Rhode Island School of Design. Mm-hmm. He's deceased, was Richard Merkin. He was a great friend. He was a great painter. And he said, you have to come to New York, because where your passion is fashion. And forget about this teaching thing. And so I said, okay. And then I got to New York, and I met Deanna Vreeland. I volunteered for her for 6 weeks. And then Mrs. Vreeland saw in me what I didn't see in myself, and she recommended me to Andy Warhol, and I worked at the factory. That was my first job. Mrs. Vreeland was the mentor that made the difference.
You write about her. Through Diana Vreeland, I learned to speak the language of style, fantasy, and literature.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an example of how you would put the, a moment in your career when you were able to put that
first
as ice
of all,
to use?
I cannot explain that in words that would be clear to your audience, but I will try to say what this meant.
Okay.
It means that she and I spoke a language there as literature was a narrative about a certain event or emotion in perhaps a novel or a biography. So therefore, when you have a dress, you must approach the dress in the same way that you would approach reading a great piece of literature. Therefore, the dress must inspire you. What is this dress in the terms of the exhibit? Is this dress a dress that is worn by a queen as Cleopatra? Was it just worn by a movie star? What is the history behind the dress? What is the narrative behind the dress? Mm. There is a story behind each dress, and therefore you must make that story come alive through gestures of the mannequin, of the model the mannequin is mounted upon, through the backdrop, to perhaps paintings that are hung behind the mannequin and the dress, to suggest this kind of historical referencing of the costume that brings it more alive, because it is a very static thing, a dress on a mannequin, i.e. a dummy in a museum exhibit. But there are so many ways to make it sing or come alive. It has a musicality. If, for example, you have a gola-may dress worn by Claudette Colbert in the 1939 version of Cleopatra, black and white, and it's gold, and you spray the mannequin gold, and the gold dress is gold, and you convey that this is a queen who lived in the sun, and so therefore her dress is gold, and she's got a golden suntan. There's so many ways, and it's just use of imagination. You let your fancy fly, your imagination. That's what I meant when it was literature. And Mrs. Vreeland was a very curious lady, and she also loved reading literature, and there was so much we shared about, you know, dresses through literature. And Marie Antoinette and the history of fashion, the history of high fashion. You must have a knowledge of things when you're doing a museum exhibit on fashion. You must have a curiosity. You must make correspondences between the actual costume, the moment it was worn, the time frame it was worn, what else was happening at that time. Was it perhaps like a Prussian War, or was it the Civil War, i.e. Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind in her green dress made from Poitiers, when she went to ask Red Butler for money to restore her homeland, Tara. And these are the things that you bring into the world of the museum exhibit. And I love curating, and I have curated 4 retrospectives of Oscar de la Renta, one at SCAD, one at De Young in San Francisco, one at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, Texas, and also one at the Met Museum in Charlotte, and they were all very successful and very rewarding. But this is what I learned from Mrs. Vreeland. You must also understand clothes from inside out. Clothes must speak to you. The linings have to be as important as the outside, mm-hmm. the exterior. The embroidery, the design, the pattern. Also, the life of the designer is also sometimes very important in the dress. So if you have an exhibit on Chanel, you've got to read everything about Chanel, because, you know, Chanel's life is very, excuse me, sorry, apologize for coughing.
Oh, no worries.
The life of Chanel is also epic. So therefore, everything that happens in Chanel's life is important to her design universe.
Right. My guest is Andre Leontali. We're talking about his memoir, The Chiffon Trenches. We'll take a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Andre Leontali. The name of his new memoir is The Chiffon Trenches. Andre, when you were an editor at Women's Wear Daily and you were living in Paris, what was different about the way the fashion industry operated in Paris as compared to New York? And how was it different for you as a black man?
Oh, Paris was the mecca of fashion, and is to this day. Paris was the mecca, the Holy Grail. And you went to Paris for the true great moments, the great creators, the great designers, the titans. You went to a world that is unique. It's larger than life. It's excellence. It stands for excellence and high creativity. And so for me as a black man going to Paris when I was the only one in 1978 sitting on the front row at an Yves Saint Laurent collection, watching this beautiful collection unfurl, where he had been inspired by Porgy and Bess, the Gershwin classic folk opera. This just was, came home to me. I felt right at home because my first big show in Paris was the Yves Saint Laurent Porgy and Bess runway couture collection. The music was played, and Leontine Price singing Summertime, and the clothes, the attitude of the clothes, where the clothes were so akin to what I'd seen, you know, black women wear in my church. The attitude, not the same kind of clothes, not as expensive, but there was just an attitude, the gestures, the way the women wore their hats with the veils, the way they wore their scarves, their chiffon scarves, the colors and everything. So Paris was the Mecca. When you went to Paris, you went to the mountaintop. When you were in New York covering fashion, fashion could be exciting, but fashion in America in those days, in the 70s, was about bread and butter. It was more commercially oriented, yet there were some great sparks of creativity in the work of Ralph Lauren, Oscar de la Renta, and Bill Blass, and Calvin Klein. But you just had a different emotional response to Paris as you did to New York. In New York, it was very, very, very bread and butter, very much, we are selling clothes here. We are very pragmatic. But in Paris, you could have the most luxurious presentations of clothes that simply were out of this world, clothes that cost, you know, upwards of $30,000 to $40,000 to $50,000. And they were unique, and that is a world that exists still today. That is a cultural world. It is a cultural world. There is a society that requires those kind of dresses, you know. The Saint Laurent and Chanel dresses, people buy those clothes who are wealthy. That is part of their culture and their lifestyle. Also, I do think that America is a very important place for fashion. It's not to be underrated, and there is always excitement. I really particularly think the work of Ralph Lauren and Carolina Herrera and Oscar de la Renta are outstanding in the world of fashion today. I'm speaking of 2020. And also Marc Jacobs. Marc Jacobs is an extraordinary, unique talent in the world of fashion.
Now, Andre, over the course of your career, you had the experience of being the one and only black person in the room in this conversation about certain things. Two-part question. When was a time in your career that you spoke up, that you knew it made a difference? And when was a time that now you look back and you thought, you know what, I should have spoken up?
Well, there's no time when I think back that I should have spoken up and I didn't. I spoke up in quiet ways. I was a quiet advocate. I did speak up, and I was quiet when Jennifer Hudson finally reached the cover of Vogue, when she was in the movie Dreamgirls, and she won an Oscar, and she won the Golden Globe. She won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. I went to 10 screenings of the movie before Christmas of the year it came out, and I kept quietly sending emails to my boss, Anna Wintour, that people would stand up and cheer in the theaters the way people stand up at football games and cheer when someone makes a touchdown. And I experienced this over 10 times, including Christmas Day, and that was a time when I made a difference and Jennifer got on the cover. I did not run into Anna Wintour's office and say, you must put Jennifer Hudson on the cover. She's great. It was a very distinct message that this girl was going to get the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress and the Golden Globes because of the anthem she sang, that great song. And that song became an anthem for her. And I think that was a very significant time. I also think that although I was not, it was not an advocate, but when I was assigned to do the first cover of our first African-American First Lady, Michelle Obama, that was the time when I made the difference at Vogue. I was assigned it, I went through it, I did it, and I was proud of it. Proud of it.
You mentioned Anna Wintour, and already has been a lot reported about your writing about her in the book, her passion for power versus clothing, her ability to cut people loose. Mm-hmm. Did you show her the manuscript, and what was her reaction, if so?
She was the first to have the manuscript. Mm-hmm. She was the first, and that was the recommendation of my editor, Pamela Cannon, at Ballantine Books. She said, you do not want to blindside Anna Wintour, and I took that advice, and we made sure she had the manuscript. The first galley went to her. She read it, And I also sent the galley with the message, if there's anything in the book you would like to remove, I feel free. I will do it. Let's discuss it. And she called me and we discussed what she wanted removed. And she wanted me to remove any references to the privacy of her children, her daughter and her son, the doctor, Charles Schaffer. And I did remove those things. And a couple of other things that were, you know, some minor things and the way I had described my time in Paris as Paris editor. She thought I should rethink that, and I took that advice. And she read the book, and she thanked me for saying nice things about her, for being a nice mother. And then I never heard from her again. That was
never?
In January.
Huh.
Well, that was in February of this year. That was not so long ago.
Right.
I've never heard from her since.
Well, you might still. There's time.
I hope.
There's time. And you write, you know, you write about a lot of your friendships and your relationships, Karl Lagerfeld, for example. And I was curious, you know, Karl Lagerfeld could be very cruel about weight. And you write about your own experiences being judged for your weight in this particular industry. Looking back, why were people so easily mean about those kind of things? Not just to you, but in general.
I think that's the way human beings are. People love to shame people. Fat shaming is a horrible thing. I mean, Carl was at one time overweight, as equally as overweight as I was, and he got the weight down. He lost in mass over 100 pounds, and he kept them off until the day he died. He was overweight at the same time, and then once you've lost 100 pounds, you become a different person. I've seen other people lose weight like that. They become the human beings that, you know, it's almost a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde transformation. Thus, the concentration on clothing and vanity becomes a priority, and perhaps the real values about friendship just go to the wayside because you're so impressed with losing 100 pounds. And he was a great friend. He was a great teacher and a great friend. I mean, we spoke the same language. I go back to that. The people that I've come across in my life, we've spoken the same language, be it about fashion, art, painting, poetry, literature. We simply spoke the same fashion, the same language, the same vocabulary. So I don't know. I still am wondering how Karl Lagerfeld dropped me as a friend of 30 years, how he had been such a close friend, and suddenly he just threw me to the wind. But he threw a lot of people to the wind. He was good for that. He got tired of a person. He would not explain. He would not call you up. He would just drop you. He dropped a lot of people.
Andre, how do you feel about the push for size inclusivity in fashion today?
It's great. It's great. There's always a plus-size model in a great fashion show. There's such diversity. Rihanna has broken the glass ceiling. She had a show last September, Fenty X Beauty, in a Barclays Center in Brooklyn, and I have never seen such an astonishing, brilliant show. She had every kind of diversity. Not only a plus-size, she had paraplegic models. She had models who have vitiligo, the skin.
Vitiligo.
Vitiligo.
Yeah.
But the most important thing is she had paraplegic models, people who had one leg removed, and they were wearing little satin teddies. Everybody was the same. Beauty was the same, and the plus size girls were the girls that there were maybe 44 professional models and maybe 80. Dancers, and it all just merged into one great big festival about style, Rihanna's version of style. And I give Rihanna the total credit. That's the first great show I've seen from a celebrity that mattered, that changed things, that redefined what a fashion show should be. The only thing missing were male models, but I think there may have been transgendered models, fluid gender models, models of all sizes, models that were 2 or 3 or 4 feet tall, and it was not a freak show. This was a show of beauty and power.
Andre, so much in your book is about friendships and how important friendships are. Of all the bold-faced names in your book, who would you say is a genuine friend? If you two were clerks in a bookstore instead of the business you were in, you know this person would be your friend.
Repeat that, please.
If you, of the people in your book, you know, we talked about how Karl Lagerfeld would drop people. People in fashion go in and out of one another's lives. Who in the book and in your life would be your friend if you two were clerks in a bookstore, if you hadn't had this fabulous backdrop of fashion?
Oh, that's clear. Naomi Campbell and Alexis Thomas, my best friend and deacon at the Abyssinian Baptist Church and chair of the trustee board. Naomi Campbell and Alexis Thomas, two African-American women of greatness and beauty and strength and power.
The name of the memoir is The Chiffon Trenches. Andre Leontali, thank you so much for sharing part of your day with
us. Well, it's absolutely wonderful to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time, and I hope the readers will have gotten something from this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andre.